I knew there was one under here somewhere. So I'll just put this bottle of water so I can afflict my soul. I think as the scripture goes, you afflict your soul on this day, right? Well, maybe I better not look at it the whole time. I think Mr. Welch was here some years ago, and we put an empty water bottle in here, just kind of an empty one, so we could get full flavor of the day. Loneliness, according to a British newspaper, comes with a warning label. 9 out of 10 people fear being alone more now than ever. The article goes on in the in a newspaper called The Express that the cost to dealing with the National Health Service in Great Britain because of loneliness or time spent alone is over 7.2 billion euros a year. Well, that's about the same amount of in money. And the numbers are going up. The taxpayer faces a bill of over 6,000 pounds on average for each, and it goes through 1.2 million chronically lonely pensioners who find themselves going to their doctor simply to have someone to talk to, or they're taken to emergency because their health conditions have worsened due to loneliness. And so the financial pressure for the public purse is becoming stiffer because people are lonely. There was a study that was done that said that 89% of people studied believe loneliness in old age is more likely than ever and is inevitable. It's going to happen. Goes to 93% of those who are over age 65. And yet they don't want to admit that the loneliness occurs. 3/4 of them, or 76% according to this survey, said they would find it hard to admit feeling lonely because they don't want to be a burden on anyone else. So this sign of loneliness is really becoming an epidemic. This particular loneliness, the concept that it is inevitable, seems to reign supreme among older folks. Now, a number of years ago, the church asked me to look after the financial affairs of a lady who was in hospice care and to look after her affairs because she didn't have family members that could do so. And so to look after things and to, you know, resolve all the issue, financial issues and clean up her apartment and resolve that. And she died 89 days after diagnosis. So it was a relatively short period of time, and I was able to get her into a nice hospice center. It was well cared for, and she was quite pleased with that. But she told me her biggest fear. She said, "I don't want to die alone. Do whatever you can. I just don't want to be alone." So she had lived her life, much of her life, alone in many ways, but that was a fear within her, and that was what, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And so I saw it myself close by, where she was simply afraid, and she wasn't the only one. They say that loneliness is really the last taboo. Everything else you could talk about, but somehow this is something that people don't want to talk about because it hits too close to home. There's another article that said that loneliness epidemic costs employers billions of dollars per year. Well, why would that be? Well, according to the study, it said that the people who expressed loneliness were more likely to leave their job within a year. They weren't having the connections and the support and the encouragement that they need. And so because of the frequency of job changes, it was costing employers a goodly amount of money. But of course, the elderly or the job changers aren't the only ones. There's a study that shows that social media now is making people even more antisocial because it's causing loneliness among the young. The more connected they are, the more isolated they become because they're alone with their little device, their little machine, to the exclusion of other people. This particular study shows that more than 2 hours of social media a day doubles the chances that a person will then experience social isolation. It's interesting in how they refer to this. They said that that the people that they surveyed from age 19 to 32 used 11 different social media platforms from which they then were able to draw some conclusions. Because being on social media encourages feelings of exclusion, and it does this because you see the photos of friends enjoying some events and you weren't invited. So now they feel excluded, and I'm not part of that particular program. I still remember it was over 10 years ago. There was a knock on my bathroom door. And I'm in the shower. Now, this is a very unusual time for something to be urgent. And one of my daughters shouted, "Dad, what do you want your password to be?" Well, my wife and one of my daughters had set up a Facebook account for me. And I said, "Well, you pick it out and I'll try to remember it." And so, because they wanted me to stay in contact with them, to see the pictures that they're referring to in these particular studies. But many people, when they go and get involved in this social media, they find that they have increased social isolation because they've decreased their actual relationships with other people, and instead they get artificial relationships or relationships via the media. And this then brings us to yet another article, again from Great Britain, where they conclude that 7 million British do not have close friends that they can spend time with. They say 1 in 8 adults, or 10%, what is that, 13%, say they have no one they would describe as a best pal. That's up from the same question when it was asked in 2014 and 2015. So they didn't have a best pal. So and then as people juggle life and they juggle their careers, and then they look to social media to fill in the gaps. But what the study concludes is they're replacing quality of relationships with quantity of relationships. How many people we know, and not how well do they know them. And to read part of this particular conclusion, social relationships are essential to our health and well-being. We mustn't take them for granted. People need support to be able to nurture personal friendships and feel a part of the community. So quality relationships are critical, not just quantity, but quality. But what is this? Let's go further on this particular article. Interesting statistics that if I can get this right, 6% of people feel that they have more than 10 close friends. That's 6%. Okay, that's not very many. Common reported number of people that considered as confidants or closest friends, most people report they have 2 or maybe 3 who are their closest friends. People with best friends are 2.5 times as likely to say they feel down or depressed or hopeless, either often or all the time. And 31, meaning as compared to those with 4 or more friends who will have that same statistic. So if you've got 4 or more close friends, the likelihood that you're going to feel down is much, much less. Younger people were more likely to feel feeling lonely as compared to older people. Almost 2/3 of 16 to 24-year-olds say they felt lonely at least some of the time, while almost 1/3 felt lonely often or all of the time. Of the older generation, among 65-plus, 32% felt lonely at least some of the time, and 11% felt lonely often or all of the time. Research here shows that loneliness can be more harmful than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That's a pretty dramatic health issue. Well, why would I bring up this issue about loneliness on a day like the Day of Atonement? Of course, the Day of Atonement means a day of at-one-ment. So I want to take a look at a few biblical examples of people who were very much alone from time to time in life, and what they did, and how we remember them. So I want us to take a look at just a few of these biblical examples. And you'll probably think of a number more, but I'm going to call to your attention the example of Moses. Moses had times when he was very much alone. In Exodus 19, this is when Moses went up the mountain alone on Mount Sinai to receive the stone tablets upon which the Ten Commandments were carved. In Exodus 19 and verse 16, and there was talking about thunderings and lightnings and a cloud on the mountain, and a trumpet was loud, the people were in the camp were trembled. And verse 17, and Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder, Moses spoke and God answered him by voice. Then the Lord came down on Mount Sinai on top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain. And Moses went up. It's Exodus 19. How would you like to be the one that was called and says, no, no, they're all there, but I want you, Moses, come up this mountain. In Exodus 24:12, and the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I've written that you may teach them. Skipping ahead to Exodus 31:18. And when he made an end of speaking with him, meaning when God made an end of speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses two tablets of testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And of course, when Moses came down the mountain alone the first time, he broke the tablets. The second time, God redid that again. We read that in Exodus 34, verse 1, where they went through that circumstance again. And each time, Moses went up the mountain alone. I've done some mountain climbing. Not the peaks where you have the ropes and all that, but where you'd have to scramble to climb up. And so everybody did it alone. And when you scrambled up the mountain and you stood on top of the mountain, you can feel truly alone when you're on top of a mountain. And you can see for a long ways. But not everybody could get there. But Moses faced that situation alone. God called him. He went. There's another story that you're familiar with, I'm sure. And that was when a young man who was the future King David was all alone when he faced the giant warrior Goliath. We read in 1 Samuel 17, we know the story well enough, that I'm just going to refer to it by chapter. But in 1 Samuel 17, we know David went to feed his older brothers. They were in the army. They were facing the Palestinians. And he stood up and said, well, who is this heathen that's going to insult God? And everybody was afraid of this giant Goliath. And David said, I'll do it. I'll go. And David went to face Goliath. Did it say that he had a whole army trotting right on his heels? No. Were his brothers right there? Maybe. Or maybe King Saul right there? No. David was there alone, as it were, from all appearances. Because he said, this Goliath will not be allowed to blaspheme God. So it was another circumstance where somebody was called to do something to defend the truth. Then we go to 1 Kings 18, a common story. Most of us know this. Elijah was left alone when he faced off against King Ahab and the priests of Baal and Asherah. And in 1 Kings 18, I'm going to just read just a couple of few verses out of there. In 1 Kings 18, starting in verse 16. Now, there was a drought. Elijah had said that unless the land repented, there would be a drought on the land. And there was, in fact, a drought. And Obadiah was the governor of King Ahab's household, of the king's palace, and he had, and so that was his job description, and they were out searching for water. He was out searching for water for the king. So 1 Kings 18:16. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, And Ahab went to meet Elijah. Ahab, or Obadiah, had stumbled into Elijah and said, whoa, surprise, surprise, to see you. And Elijah was worried he was going to be killed. And Obadiah said, I don't think God will allow that, or some such. And so Obadiah went and met Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. Verse 17, then it happened, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Now let's think about that. Elijah's all alone. And the most powerful man in his world, King Ahab, with an army at his resource, of a great resource for him, who could order him stricken, whose wife, Queen Jezebel, would love to see him dead. And then he says, is that you, O troubler of Israel? Do you suppose Elijah felt alone at that time? He did. In fact, he thought that he alone was saved out of all those who were believers in God. In another verses, we find that Obadiah was also a believer and saved many priests by smuggling water and bread off to them. But let's continue in this story. In First Kings 18:18, and he answered, Elijah, meaning, I've not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you've forsaken the commandments of God, of the Lord, and have followed the Baals, meaning false gods. Now, therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, and 450 prophets of Baal, and 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table. So Jezebel was feeding them even through the drought and the famine. And there was Elijah. Does it say that Elijah had a lot of buds hanging around him? You go, buddy. You can do this. No. No. Humanly, he was alone. There was another one who was alone. We have an entire book of the Bible that carries his name. And that is the captive Israelite prince, whose name was Daniel, was quite alone when he was thrown into the lion's den as a consequence for praying to God. And we know that story about Daniel, is that when he was in there, and it was Daniel was alone, and the lion's mouths were shut up, and he came out, and he was untouched, unscathed. How would you like to be in the lion's den alone? Now, I've been to some zoos. They say the decibel level of a lion, or how it rumbles, is very much like thunder, has that loud, thundering, quaking sound. And I've heard the lion roar. In fact, if you really want an exciting time to hear a lion roar, go to Wildlife Safari in Escondido, California. It's owned by the same people who own the San Diego Zoo. And then ask for their little camping expedition in the middle of this 1,000-acre preserve or whatever, where the lions are running free, and then you live in a little fenced-in area along the way, and you can be there overnight and hear the lions roar and watch them tickle your innards, because you will likely be quite aware of how active the place is at night. And yet, Daniel was right there, and seemingly all alone. There's another experience, and I do want to call attention to this, where God gave instructions on who should be alone and what they were to do when they were alone. Let's turn to Exodus 26. Exodus 26, verse 31. And the background, this is the background on developing a tabernacle. And this was in the wilderness. And this is what God is instructing, how to build a tabernacle. And he goes through great detail on this tabernacle. In verse 30, Exodus 26, verse 31. And you shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen. It shall be woven with an artistic design of cherubim. Verse 33, and you shall hang the veil from the clasps, and you shall bring the ark of the testimony in there behind the veil. And the veil shall be a divider for you between the holy places and the most holy. Well, we can learn a little bit more of what God had in mind about this tabernacle, about he had a special place that was very special inside the tabernacle, and it was surrounded with a veil. When we read about Solomon's temple, let's take a look at 1 Kings 6, verses 15 through 17. 1 Kings 6, verses 15 through 17, we can see a little bit more of what God had in mind. Starting in verse 15, and he built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards from the floor of the temple to the ceiling. He paneled the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the temple with planks of cypress. Then he built the 20-cubit room at the rear of the temple. 20 cubits is about 30 feet. So about 30 feet square, roughly. From floor to ceiling with cedar boards, he built it inside as the inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. And in front of the temple sanctuary was 40 cubits long. So in other words, in front of it, there was a place in front of it, and then it was enclosed, because we know that it was enclosed with a veil. Now let's go back to Exodus 30, verse 10. What happened in this holy of holy places? What happened there? We read in Exodus 30, 10. And Aaron, now Aaron was Moses' brother. Aaron was appointed to be the high priest. And Aaron shall make an atonement upon its horns once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. Once a year he shall make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It's most holy to the Lord. So once a year, Aaron was supposed to make a particular offering of atonement. And that he was allowed to come in to that place once a year. We're going to read more references to that in a moment. This is also in Leviticus 16 and verse 34. In Leviticus 16, 34. This shall be an everlasting statute for you to make atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year. And he did as the Lord commanded Moses. So there's going to be a time, and this was the time of year that we're talking about, is the Day of Atonement, when this sin offering was to be held. So there was a requirement for the high priest. He was to come in. It was separated with a veil. It was the most holy place. And now let's fast forward to the time of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ became that high priest, and then through his sacrifice made it possible for all of us to have direct access to God. Now, what did we read earlier? The high priest made an atonement, made a sacrifice for the sins of the people. So the people had to rely upon the high priest to make that sacrifice. So now let's look forward into Hebrews 3:1. Who's the new high priest? In Hebrews 3:1. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus. So Jesus Christ was considered then among Christians to be the high priest of our belief system. So let's take a look at one was the foretype of the ancient Hebrew priest after the priesthood of Aaron. And now we've got the priesthood of Jesus Christ. And what does the priest do is offers a sacrifice for the sins of the people. And he does it in that holy place once a year. And now let's take a look at Luke 22 and verse 42. And this is describing the death of Jesus Christ when he's hanging on the stake. And he's in agony. And he has the nails. He's been beaten. He's been whipped. He's wearing a crown of thorns. The blood is running down his head. He's in utter agony as he takes upon him the sins of mankind. And he says, and he's praying and says, Luke 22, verse 42, if it is your will, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. This was a very lonely time. Jesus Christ was doing it alone. He was having to carry that burden. And then we look at Mark 15 in verse 37. In Mark 15 in verse 37. And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Then the veil of the temple was torn in two from the bottom up. Why? Why was that veil torn at the time of Christ's death? The veil of the torn, and we'll read in Hebrews 9, and we'll start there in a moment. But the veil was torn because previously the high priest had to go in and make a sacrifice for people to atone for their sins, that they could be right with God. And now, because the veil was torn, the imagery was such that people could directly approach God and could directly have a relationship with God. Let's turn to Hebrews in 9, Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 1. Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine services and earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, which was the lampstand, the table, the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that had budded, and tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. So the writer of Hebrews is describing this original Ark of the Covenant. Behind, in the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies, where God would reside or come to, behind a veil. Going on in verse 6. Now when these things had been thus prepared, we're looking at Hebrews 9, verse 6. The priest always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. Verse 7. But under the second part, the high priest went alone once a year, not without blood, meaning there had to be a sacrifice, for which he offered for himself and the people's sins committed in ignorance. So there was an offering. There was a sacrifice because the people sinned. And only the high priest could go in past the veil. Verse 8, and the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. It was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the sacrifice or service perfect in regard to conscience. Concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. Let's go to verse 11. But Christ came as the high priest of good things to come, with a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not made of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more should the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from the dead works to serve the living God? And for this reason, he, meaning Christ, is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, and those who are called, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. This spells it out. This tells us the veil was rent. Christ was that sacrifice. It says for once and for all. That was it. That was now. Now we have an access to receive the promise of eternal inheritance. But we have to be willing to do that. We have to make a conscious choice. We have to respond to the call of God. We have to be at one with God. So if we look at in Leviticus 23, what do we read about this day? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Leviticus 23. And we read how this is spelled out. About this particular day. And we'll come to it. And the 10th day, verse 27 of Leviticus 23, also the 10th day of this 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls. So holy convocation, meaning coming together, afflicting your souls. That's the terminology used for fasting, doing without food and water, and make an offering, made by fire to the Lord. And you'll do no work on that day, for it's a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For any person who's not afflicted in soul, meaning in body, on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. It shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening, which would have been last evening. From evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath. And what's the purpose? What's the function? A holy convocation. Did God ask us to do this part alone? No, he said, you can come, be together, to reinforce, to encourage one another. Yet individually, we all fast alone. I don't know of anybody who can eat for you. I don't know of anybody else that can do those sorts of things for you. But we can fellowship together. We can come together on a convocation as we together afflict our souls and make an offering. So we have this opportunity then to follow up what the ancient Israelites didn't. They had to rely on the high priest to come before the altar with that offering. Christ made it possible for us with the renting of the veil, his death. The veil's now open. We have access directly to God. We can be at one with God, and that would resolve much of the loneliness of mankind. Because if they're at one with God, well, then they're following what God asked them to do, which is a formula for happiness. And of course, there's much to do with the entire subject of loneliness. But I wanted to emphasize this today, that our opportunity is to join together with God. And God gives us an instruction booklet on how, and in this booklet, we don't have to be humanly unhappy and humanly lonely when we connect with God's people. And we can do that every week and every annual holy day season and as often as we can throughout the year. Moses was alone on Mount Sinai and followed God. The high priest alone went into the Holy of Holies once per year to make atonement for the people. The future young King David stood alone against Goliath and prevailed. Elijah the prophet stood alone facing King Ahab and 450 prophets of Baal and 400 of Asherah on Mount Carmel. Prince Daniel was alone in the lion's den. Jesus Christ was alone on the crucifixion stake. Each one of us fast alone. And in that fasting, we can draw close to God so that we can be at one with God and will never be alone again.